Hi, my name is Dave Page, and welcome to another edition of the PCRF podcasts. I'm here with
Dr. Aaron Burnett. I'm a pre-hospital medicine fellow with Regents Hospital EMS.
And I'm Dr. Keith Wesley, medical director for Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Marshall Washick, paramedic with Health East Medical Transportation.
It's a great pleasure to discuss a paper by Jonathan Studnick, Dr. Studnick. This is the association between pre-hospital endotracheal intubation attempts and survival to hospital discharge among out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And it appeared in the Society for Academic Emergency Medicine Journal, 2010. The reason, just as an editorial note, that I'm excited about this is that Dr. Studnick, of course, finished a fellowship at the National Registry, is a paramedic, and it is just a pleasure and an honor to have a paramedic publishing research in SAEM. So when I see that, and I think we're at the PCRF hoping that other paramedics choose to do research and go out there and do this, Dr. Studnick has a PhD, not an MD, and we really want to see other paramedics involved. And of course, in his study, several other paramedics are involved. So that editorial aside, Dr. Wesley, do you want to walk us through the mechanics of this particular paper?
Yeah, I thought this was a very interesting study, and actually even expanding on what you said about Jonathan, there's six listed authors, actually seven listed authors on this study, and only three of them are physicians. So I think that speaks well for this program in involving pre-hospital providers. So, research is not just for doctors, and I think that this one really shows the value of having pre-hospital providers be involved in it, because their discussion in this article is very on point as far as taking, what is the take-home message. But to the study, this is out of Mecklenburg County in North Carolina, and it's a retrospective evaluation. We can talk about the pros and cons of retrospective studies as we evaluate this, but they wanted to look at this. The idea was to determine, was there an association or not an association with endotracheal intubation and ROSC in cardiac arrest? So that's a big undertaking right there. But they had 1,142 cardiac arrests. They got the information out of the pre-hospital run report, and they had ROSC out of 299, so that's an ROSC of 26.2, and they defined ROSC as sustained ROSC at the ER. So not just ROC at the scene,
you get a pulse back and it lasts all the way to the ER.
And it lasts all the way to the hospital, that's right. They found that the patients who had no endotracheal attempt, they were 2.3 times more likely to have ROSC than those who had either one attempt that was unsuccessful and they got the attempt, or multiple attempts. So no endotracheal intubation. And so it's assumed that they bagged them all the way to the hospital, and that those patients were two times more likely to have ROSC at the arrival at the hospital. And so, again, it's an association study. And so their conclusion is that endotracheal intubation in cardiac arrest is associated with a significantly lowered probability of ROSC.
And it's important to kind of remind everybody that causality here was not established. It's not that the fact that you don't get an endotracheal tube or you get an endotracheal tube causes you to end up surviving. They've just found an association. It's worth talking about.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I go down, I want to go down in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. 26% ROSC rate? That's unheard of. I would love to know what they're doing there, because if we could recreate that across the country, we would be saving a lot of lives. But the skeptic in me has some questions about how generalizable this study really is and what were the patients they were seeing to have a one in four return of spontaneous circulation. Have any of you guys seen
that? It was even more than that, though. That was overall one in four. Of the patients that did not get an endotracheal tube attempt, they were just bagged, they had a 46% ROSC. So that's where that two times. They were twice as likely. So 45% of the patients that did not get that were just bagged had ROSC, and their survival to discharge was 28% compared to around 6 or 7%, which is kind of the national average. So a significantly greater likelihood of survival to discharge. I mean, it certainly makes sense if you deliver more ROSCs to the ER, you're going to have more patients discharged from the hospital.
Well, something that I really love about this paper is that they actually split out all the different rhythms. So you see survivability by presenting ECG rhythm, which I think really helps when we're talking about cardiac arrest research. Obviously, VFib, VTAC is a much more survivable rhythm. And so I'll tell you what did scare me about this particular paper was I don't know, I may be old school here, but in my impression of paramedics intubating, which is, of course, at issue and very much being debated, it seems to me that your success rate when you intubate should be in the upper 90% overall. And I don't know, if we can split hairs about people taking a look, so to speak, and going in there and actually assessing the airway with a laryngoscope before they actually try and introduce the tube. But at least, in my opinion, at the end of the day, when you go for it, you should be able to get it 90-plus percent of the time. And it did seem like, that is not happening on these cardiac arrests. Now, is it because they're doing it while compressions are going? And one would say that today that's the best thing to do because we don't want to interrupt compressions because that would be a bad thing. But I have to ask, maybe it is worth waiting for the 2-minute cycle to end and at the pulse check being absolutely ready to sink the tube, a few minutes into the arrest kind of thing.
Well, and that's what, the authors didn't tell us about when the attempts occurred. But I guess, let's break some of the numbers down. The percentage of their patients that they worked that didn't have an ET attempt was 17.9%. Those that got a single successful intubation was 50%. A single unsuccessful was 6.1%. Multiple ET attempts and then a successful was 11%. So I guess that's anything more than one. They didn't tell us what the average of more than one was. And then the multiple attempts unsuccessful was 14%. Again, what was the average number? Not knowing what their protocol, if they were limited to two or they limited to three, we've already reviewed the Henry Wang study where in Pennsylvania they had systems do up towards the 7 attempts that were unsuccessful. But without fail, when you compare the single attempt successful, 25% ROSC, single unsuccessful attempt, 28%. So really not much of a difference between the successful ROSC, between a single successful and a single unsuccessful. Kind of interesting. So if I try once and I miss, but then I get it in on the second try, I have the same ROSC as if I got it in the first time. So there would indicate that failing once doesn't decrease your ROSC, but then if I fail multiple times and get it in, my ROSC drops down to 17%, and if I fail a whole bunch of times and continue to fail, my ROSC is further decreased to 11%.
Yeah, and I wonder if some of that is just comorbidities. I mean, it's harder to intubate big people, so of course you're going to have multiple attempts, and of course those people are going to die. People who have Rieger or may have anatomical differences, may also have other comorbidities that make them less likely to survive. So, are we associating intubation just because of other factors other than just their ability to survive? I'm not sure.
And, you know, when you intubate, you got to be good, but you got to be quick, too. It's not enough to just be good and get that tube in 99% of the time. If it takes you 2 minutes to put that tube in, you can get it 100% of the time, but that's 2 minutes with no blood flow because you're not doing compressions.
Good point.
I know in our system, we're starting
to have, you're not breathing. If you're RSIing somebody and they're not breathing and, you know, you're taking 2 minutes to do it, that's a problem.
Absolutely. And I know in our system, we're starting to have some very intense discussions about what's really the role of intubation in cardiac arrest. Should we be intubating patients in cardiac arrest? Should we be delaying intubation? What's the role of supraglottic airways? My personal feeling is, as long as you can ventilate a patient, if you can do it with a bag valve mask and an oral airway, if you can do it with a supraglottic airway like the King or the Combi tube, then you don't need to take the step to do an endotracheal intubation until you get pulses back. Now, when you get pulses back, I think it's much more important to intubate. But if you can ventilate that patient with basic techniques, if it's not broken, don't fix it.
I love this argument because, I sort of like being a fly on the wall in the emergency department when a cardiac arrest is being worked and seeing if the emergency department actually follows the advice that they give the paramedics to do. Let's watch and see if in the emergency department nobody intubates and you just go ahead and bag them for a while and do compressions. I think the protection of that airway is an issue. And I'll go take you back to the days of the EOA when I was handed a new device and told, this is the solution, this is the answer, this is going to be the right thing. And there were studies to prove that it was the right thing. And then, you know, little by little, vomit after vomit, poor seal, problems that kept coming back. Eventually we said, actually we do want to protect the airway. Today, especially if you're talking about using an impedance threshold device, you could have to argue that having a good seal there is not a bad thing, and protecting the lungs is not a bad thing. So I want to agree that, man, it is time to do this skill right. And as an educator, it is time for me to look seriously, not just look, but change the way I'm teaching people to intubate so that they are successful. And at the same time, I'm not ready to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Let's see what other devices come along in terms of video laryngoscopes that make that procedure a little bit easier to do.
Mr. Page, you can
bring it on, brother. Bring it on.
All right. you can teach till you're blue in the face. And as far as I'm concerned, I had a fantastic instructor who taught me to intubate well.
was that Mr. Page?
Maybe.
Good save, Marshall. Keep working the room, man.
But at the end of the day, paramedics 5 years from now who go through any paramedic program, if they don't have enough intubation attempts throughout the year, can you reasonably expect them to maintain proficiency if you're getting less than
if they don't intubate their cardiac arrest, they will never have proficiency at intubating at all. And that, if that's the argument.
Well, no, but what I'm saying is in general, when it comes to intubation, I think that on the whole, especially in paramedic systems, paramedics don't get enough exposure to endotracheal intubation attempts. And as a result of that, whether you had the best instructor in the world, or the worst instructor in the world, it doesn't matter because your skills are eventually going to degrade. And so...
Throw out intubation. Is that where you're at?
I'm not advocating...
You traitor to the cause.
I'm not advocating throwing it out because there are systems out there where there are paramedics that get 20 or 30 tubes a year and they maintain a high level of proficiency. But there are services out there, say... War Road, Minnesota, who may do 500 calls an entire year and have two paramedics. How many cardiac arrests are they going to run, and how many intubation attempts are they going to have? I don't know.
I think, though, you know, and this is a good debate, this is a good issue, but I'm not sure it's germane to this study, because even the patients who had one attempt and it's successful, let's throw them a bone, say they did it right. They put the laryngoscope in, they put the tube in. They didn't take 2 minutes to do it. But even so, the ROSC was half what it was if they didn't even try. So maybe it's not the skill itself. Maybe it's the procedure. Maybe it's the placement of an endotracheal tube and the positive pressure ventilation that always ensues by having an ET tube.
I have to agree with you there.
Patients are get bagged with higher volumes and higher pressures when an ET tube is in than they do without an ET tube.
Yes, and the more pressure we have in the chest, the worse things become for circulation.
So maybe it's not the procedure of the endotracheal tube itself, but what happens after the tube is in place.
I couldn't agree with you more.
So now let's have another
Hence,
study.
Let's talk about ventilators, portable ventilators, instead of humans trying to remember, oh, I should breathe right now, oh, I should breathe again.
Exactly. So let's do the same study, and as soon as the patient is tubed, you put them on an automatic transport ventilator that controls for pressure and volume, and see if that negative association of the tube doesn't go away.
You know, that's a great point.
You know, it's amazing how things change over time. I haven't been at this game as long as Dr. Wesley, but acute lung injury, ARDS, you know, we used to bag them to death too. And we found over just the last 10, 15 years that if you decrease the amount you ventilate them, you decrease the tidal volumes, you decrease the pressure, they do better. I'm starting to wonder if that's the exact same thing we're starting to learn about CPR, and that we might be right on the cusp of this huge shift in how we address cardiac arrest.
Well, you know, to support this, and it's, you know, it sounds like I'm on a soapbox here, because we just completed at Health East looking at the last 2 years' worth of our cardiac arrest data. And we said, well, let's see if we have any kind of association of ROSC based upon the airway device that's used.
Are you going to publish that data, Dr.
Wesley?
We
are going to publish this data.
Oh, okay.
Those patients that had, the medics had, they could either go King airway first or ET first. If they failed with the ET, they had to go to the King. The patients who they went directly to the King were four times more likely to have ROSC than if they went to an ET tube first and failed.
And all the supraglottic lovers can cheer with you, sir. And I should say, this is such an emotionally charged thing, and I am playing devil's advocate today. I don't know if supraglottics are better than endotracheal tubes, and I am really concerned about endotracheal tubes myself. So I want to just put that out there on the record that it is time to let go of those old stereotypes about, you know, we're paramedics, we have to intubate. ALS is all about intubation and drugs. Clearly, BLS, good chest compressions, some good management of the cardiac arrest in general is really turning out to be much more important.
If you look at the things that save lives in CPR, it's nothing real fancy. It's quality CPR that buys you time until you get a defibrillator, and then you can shock a shockable rhythm. Anything more than that, if you truly look at the science, drugs don't do you a whole lot. Intubation, it's kind of up in the air now. So chest compressions and early defibrillation, that's what saves lives and cardiac arrest.
All right, now I'm going to do the flip-flop on you.
Because just after I gave in, I conceded, no, I made my speech.
It has to do with the shortcoming.
I retract. Intubation, no. It's all where it's at.
I totally disagree. But the authors of the study did fail to give us some information that I think is important. And that is, what was the hemodynamic status and neurologic status of the patients who were bagged? Now, first thing when I read this, well, of course, the patients who got bagged are the ones who got timely AED, and they shocked, and they were coming around, they were breathing spontaneously. Well, now, they state clearly in their limitations that they recognize that, but that from their review of the records, only 29 of the patients had spontaneous ROSC and had patent enough airways that they could breathe on their own. And so they thought that those 29 would not change the numbers. But what about the other patients that they bagged? What was their GCS? Were they breathing at all spontaneously? Did they have agonal respirations, or were they assisting ventilations? Makes a big difference if they were bagging apneic patients or if they were assisting ventilations with hypoventilated patients. So it's a big leap to say, stop ET tubing and just bag your cardiac arrest patients in. I don't know. This study does not tell you that. It implies that. It implies that you should just bag, we ought to just bag all cardiac arrests so that we get ROSC back. I'm not sure that that's the right answer, because there's a big difference between bagging someone who's totally apneic, who has total no tone in their and no patent airway without the bag and the OP, and the person who is coming out of the ROSC and has tone and they're spontaneously breathing to some degree and you're assisting their ventilations.
I love how research can be, you know, everybody wants to say, well, this study showed this, but in fact, 90% of the time we find ourselves saying, well, this study opens the door to say, we've learned a little bit, now we need to learn more. And for those listening who really aspire to do research, I would not be discouraged by the arguments and the, but rather energized. I think you're going to find that some papers are better than others, but overall, all of them contribute something to our base knowledge. And as long as they're done ethically and well, we get something out of it. Well, thanks again for tuning in to another edition of the PCRF podcasts.